welcome to the Layer 8 Podcast Season 3, culminating with the Layer 8 Conference on Saturday, October 8th in Providence, Rhode Island. This season, we'll have conversations with social engineers and OSINT investigators who will tell their stories. We hope you enjoy them. Welcome to another episode of the Layer 8 Podcast. We have a very special guest with us today. We have Stephen Harris. Welcome, Stephen.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
For the benefit of our listeners, could you let them know a little bit about who you are?
Sure. My name is Stephen Harris. Online, I go by the pseudonym NixIntel. I am a senior open source intelligence specialist at Complex, and I am a member of the OSINT Curious podcast and webcast. I teach SANS Sec487, which is the Introduction to OSINT course. And prior to doing that, I was in law enforcement for a long time, working in cybersecurity and OSINT. So yeah, OSINT's my thing, you could say.
And one of the places where people can see more about you, and I think you also have your own OSINT resources page, as well as an incredible listing of blog posts, which we can talk a little bit more about, is at nixintel.info. So that's nixintel.info seems to be the place where people can find out a whole lot more about you on there.
Yeah, all the blog posts I've written, my links and my resources for all my OSINT stuff are on there, usually.
You mentioned OSINT Curious, I believe that you're a board member of OSINT Curious. What is OSINT Curious? What's that all about?
OSINT Curious is a nonprofit organization mostly made up of OSINT practitioners, professionals, enthusiasts from different parts of the world. It was set up by Micah Hoffman and a few of his sort of close associates probably about 3-4 years ago now. And the reason it was set up was to help the community understand OSINT, improve their skills, broaden their knowledge base. Because I wasn't there at the start. I joined after it being going maybe a year or 2 years. But our mission is to make high quality OSINT material available for free for everybody. So we do webcasts, we write blog posts, we do short 10-minute tip training videos, and so on and so on. So our overall mission is, I guess, to put material out there that people who are just getting into OSINT or people who have been in the space for a long time, we want to put out materials that they'll find useful to help improve their skills.
I really love the 10-minute videos for people like me who don't have much of an attention span. Those cover a lot of great topics all across the board.
Yeah, definitely. So everything from how to use sort of basic Python tools, how to geolocate images, how to do things on social media, how to investigate websites, and so on and so on. We keep adding more to it, so sort of the repository keeps growing. But yeah, there is quite a large number of topics that are in there.
And as you mentioned, those resources are also free, which is great for people trying to start up in the industry.
Yeah, absolutely. We don't charge for anything. We recognize that there is a huge demand from people in all different professions, not just in cybersecurity, not just in law enforcement, but it's like the last few years, the demand for what people call OSINT has really, really grown because businesses, government agencies are realizing that they need to understand the internet. They need to understand the data that is out there about them and their companies and the problems it poses, the opportunities that it offers. And we figured at OSINT Curious that there is clearly a huge knowledge and skills gap in that area. So some of the things we put out are aimed at addressing that. The feedback we get is good. So as long as people keep liking what we make, then we'll continue to do it.
And that's incredible that there's those resources there. And sometimes people want something a little bit more, something that's instructor driven. You also teach a class for SANS. Is that an OSINT class?
It is, yes. Yeah. So the class is Sec487, which is an open source intelligence class. It's now one of two classes that SANS have. For OSINT, the Sec487, which I teach, is the introduction to OSINT. The new course, Sec587, is a little more advanced. But on the intro to OSINT course, we teach the students absolutely everything from the basic principles of intelligence. How do I actually find things? How do I analyze things? How do I plan my research? And then once we've done that, we will look at different areas like, how do we investigate people? How do I investigate and research websites? How do I deal with image geolocation? How do I do things in threat intelligence, and so on and so on? But we really put the emphasis, especially early in the course, on actually building the knowledge foundations for making good intelligence. I think one of the big conceptions that people sometimes have about OSINT is it's just fancy Googling. Like, you're just Googling, that's all you're doing, right? Or you're just running a scan, that's all you're doing. And that's one of the preconceptions people have. But actually, if you don't know what you're doing at the start, and you don't know how to gather the data, and you don't know how to analyze it properly, you'll run into problems and you'll make mistakes. And that's one of the habits that we try and build in people right to the start, which is it's not about just about Googling. It's not a CTF where you just got to run out and find stuff as soon as possible. Good intelligence means that you've checked things to see if they're true. You've weighed up how important they are. You aren't just shouting out the first thing that comes to you. So we push a lot on the analysis side. So the students will come away not just knowing how to find stuff on the internet, but actually how to turn it into something useful for their organizations.
I think that's great to be able to differentiate between just data and actual OSINT, because there is definitely a difference there, isn't there, between just data points and actual OSINT?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So data gathering is easy, but it's not, or it's relatively easy, but it's not necessarily meaningful. So when I'm doing OSINT, for example, for a client, and they want to say, they know, want to understand the risk to their business from ransomware or from fraud, for example, if I just go and grab a load of raw data and dump that into a report, it's unintelligible. It doesn't actually mean anything to them. It's just a load of ones and zeros and bit about servers and data and things like that. So what we encourage people to do with the data is, yeah, you've got the data, but that's just the first part of the journey. What are you actually trying to find out? What questions are you trying to answer? You know, what risk does this pose? You know, what does this mean in terms of your wider objective, and so on and so on? So we have to take that data that we get and refine it. We need to verify it. We might need to tidy it up. It might be old. It might be false information. And then we have to ask, okay, so what does this actually mean? What are my actionable takeaways? What's my, you know, three-line summary? These are three things you need to do. That's the intelligence part. It's probably the least exciting part about OSINT, because when you say OSINT, everyone's like, oh, great, yeah, I'll go find this database, and I'll go and find where someone lives, and I'll go and find like their passwords in the breach. That's just the gathering part. You have to actually take that data you've gathered and turn it into something that your audience, your client, can understand. And that's the skill we try and teach. And that's the bridge between someone who's a data gatherer and someone who's an intelligence practitioner.
And I like that you brought up the idea of certain questions that you have to answer, because I think in a little bit, I was going to ask you some more about some of those questions, which are specifically from one of the blog posts that you wrote, one from a couple of years ago about gap analysis. But before we get to that, can we talk a little bit more about how you got into the field of OSINT? How did you get started?
Yeah, so I'm kind of here entirely by accident, so don't copy me if you want to get into the field of OSINT. I started out in, I always had an interest in computers, even when I was at university, like maybe even before that, when I was at school, in my last couple of years of high school, we got the internet at school. It was dial-up, of course, and we only had one computer. But I remember how interesting this was, that you suddenly had this world of information at your fingertips. And yes, it was slow, and finding things was really hard. And when you explain this to people these days who've just grown up with the internet, it's hard to explain how captivating that idea was, that there's all this information that you had to look up in a book, maybe, if there was a book about it beforehand, was suddenly there on your computer in front of you. And I always maintain that interest. And all the way through, I dabbled a bit in making websites, and I learned about the sort of the very basics of the internet. And then I ended up working in law enforcement and had nothing to do with computers. Then I became a detective after a couple of years in the police. And dealt with all the usual detective things, like sort of violent crime, murders, robberies, and so on. after, I think it's around about the time that social media suddenly became really popular, and social media started to feature more and more heavily the crimes we were investigating. So disputes started on Facebook now. And we're going back sort of more than 10 years here now, but disputes started on Facebook. There was Twitter, which was much more open then than it is now. Everyone had a Twitter account, and people posted things much more openly than they do now. And it became clear in my work that I had to understand this space because criminals were using it. It's where our crimes were starting and where there was evidence to be found. And we had to understand it. And I met a lot of resistance. I still remember I'd been a detective only about a year, so I was a bit of a newbie. I remember I was investigating a robbery of a taxi driver that had happened. I remember using Twitter to appeal for witnesses. Like, I mean, appealing for witnesses, it's just a basic investigative skill. You're like, were you in the area? Did you see this? And so on and so on. I remember using Twitter to reach out to people who'd been in a particular location. Did you hear anything? Did you see anything? My boss went crazy that I'd done this. Like, she was a bit more old school. I remember like being dragged into her office and how dare you do this? And like, don't you know, you have to have permission, you can't do this. And kind of like, it seems bizarre now that I was trying to make use of social media to do that. But over time, the police eventually caught up and realized, yeah, we need to understand this space. And at the same time, cybercrime was becoming way more of an issue. So we begin to see things like ransomware became much more of a problem as everything became more connected. We began to see sexual abuse, especially involving children, the internet became a very powerful enabler for that. And it just the problem just sort of mushroomed. And we had to get to grips with it. Internet enabled fraud. So the internet's a great effort multiplier, right? So if I wanted to burgle a house in the old days, I had to physically go to the house, check out no one was there, and then break a window, force a door, and go in and burgle it. But with cybercrime, criminals found you could just write a script that will do something. So I can do something, instead of doing it once in person, I can do it 1,000 times, 10,000 times, 100,000 times. And so the cybercrime and all these other internet-enabled offences just took advantage of automation very often, and they just mushroomed. And so about 2016, the police in the UK began to invest quite heavily in cybercrime. And I ended up working in a cybercrime unit. And because relative to the average UK police officer, I had a fairly strong knowledge of computing. The bar might not have been particularly high, but I had interest in computing, and I had a couple of good colleagues who are really, really into computers. And I started working in cybercrime. And so over years, I kind of became the go-to guy for, can you find this on Facebook for me? Or I've got this fraud and they're based in the Middle East. Can you tell me about the company? And I began doing we didn't call it OSINT. It was OSINT. It's absolutely what it was. We were given tasks to find things, find people, find property, find assets, uncover criminal organizations, find missing persons. And we were tasked with that. And we would use the internet to the best of our ability to try and solve these problems. And then we would fire out intelligence reports. We got really good at finding child abusers on the internet. Predominantly using open source intelligence in those intelligence packs, finding skiddy hackers who were causing problems, like disrupting ransomware and so on and so on. And I was doing that for many, many years. And I was at a conference. It's a law enforcement conference, maybe 4 or 5 years ago now. And Elliot Higgins was there. You might know him. He's the founder of Bellingcat, who are a very prominent journalistic organization who have really been trailblazers for open source intelligence. And Elliot came to do a presentation at the conference on geolocation. I don't know if you've seen Elliot do a presentation or if you've read some of Bellingcat stuff or seen their work. They're really, really good. They tell very compelling stories and the way they weave all the data points together. And they're really, really good. And Elliot gave a great presentation about to do with an airstrike that they geolocated and find all these bits of information from photos and just using Google Earth and Google Maps. And it blew everyone's mind. Everyone who's at the conference, wow, like, how do we get to do that? I'm not someone who had been at the conference, contacted me afterwards, said, how do I get Bellingcat? How do I install Bellingcat? There's this software called Bellingcat that will do this, all this image analysis for you. Like, no, I think you weren't paying attention throughout if you thought that was the case. But I came back from that conference and I kind of thought, like, we had been doing that in our team, and I had been doing that personally for some time. The geolocation was mostly around trying to find missing people and trying to identify sexual abuse victims, actually. That was one of the roles that we had in our office, and I supported the team who did that. It's kind of a sad and quite a dark subject, but every time you arrest a sex offender and you examine their hard drive, you would often find what we call first generation images. So new photos of child abuse that had not been seen by law enforcement before. And apart from prosecuting the suspect, one of the missions of law enforcement in the UK is to identify as far as we can who those children are. Where are they? Because we want to safeguard them. We want to stop the abuse happening to them. I had been doing that for quite some time. Then after everyone was so enthused by what they'd seen for Elliot Higgins, I thought, well, actually, like, maybe no one knows that I'm doing this, and that some of us have a capability to do that. So I began blogging pseudonymously. So I didn't have permission from work. I didn't know if I needed permission or not. So I figured, well, we will avoid that issue. and I will blog. But I needed a sort of an example that people could relate to. So, and obviously I couldn't blog about, this is how you find child abuse victims, this is how you find suspects who are on the run. So on Twitter, I came across an account called QuizTime, which is run by a group of mostly journalists from Germany and the Netherlands. And they publish a photo challenge quiz every day. So they post an image of somewhere in the world. You have to figure out where it is and answer a question about it. So I thought, oh, this is perfect, because it was fun to do. And I thought, I can write about these without giving away any sensitive information. Like, I don't have to write about real cases. And so what I tried to do when I was blogging about all these things to do with QuizTime was to try and bring, I guess, traditional investigative techniques from my detective background to the world of OSINT and geolocation, because it was still, and still is to a certain extent, OSINT can be a bit of a wild west in terms of techniques and standards and methodology. So I wanted to try and show people how to do stuff and try and put some methodology into it as well. So it wasn't just a point and click, this is how you do this. I tried to be a bit more systematic in how I wrote and explained about things. And I did that for, I still do that. I'd been doing that for a while. And then I think Micah Hoffman, who I did not know at that point, Micah is a founder of the OSINT Curious Project. And he and a couple of others from the OSINT Curious Project reached out to me and said, hey, would you like to be a guest on our webcast? Because at that point, like today, they would interview people from the world of OSINT. And I said, yeah, sure. So anyway, I went on OSINT Curious and they interviewed me about some OSINT stuff. And then that was on a Sunday night, and I was in work the next day on the Monday. And I got this random phone call from someone in the police who said, hey, were you on the OSINT Curious webcast yesterday? I'm like, yes. Are you Nick Sintel? I'm like, yes. Oh, like, you obviously know a lot about open source intelligence. So yeah, we've been looking for a lead practitioner for internet intelligence and investigation. 3i, they call it. It's really effectively OSINT, or OSINT is a large part of it. So how do you like to be, the force lead practitioner on this subject matter? Because you clearly know more about it than everyone else. So that was it. So I didn't get in trouble with my boss. It actually kind of helped. It was nice to have that reassurance, because it could have gone very badly if my employer had taken it the wrong way. So I kind of continued to blog. I eventually joined the OSINT Curious Project as a full-time member not long after. And yeah, after maybe a year or two of doing that, during the pandemic, I left the police and I went to work for a cybersecurity company called Complex. And we get to do OSINT all day long now. It's great. So yeah, I have carried on building on my background in law enforcement, doing the investigative stuff. I've tried to codify it and bring standards and methodology to it through what I've written and what I've taught. And now I'm really lucky I get to be at Complex all day doing OSINT for clients who want OSINT doing. Yeah, it's great.
Are there typical types of investigations that you do at Complex, or could it be just about anything?
It can be just about anything. Our call work, I mean, Complex is mainly a cybersecurity company, and we help on the intelligence side. So I have a small team of intelligence practitioners, of which I'm a part. We are trying to help clients understand risk. I know that. So we want to try and help companies understand where there are skeletons in the closet, where there are risks to their business from ransomware, from rogue employees, from court cases that they didn't know about, from patents that are causing the problems, where there are technical risks to their systems. So every company, no matter how big, will usually have the server that they forgot about 5 years ago and they took it off their asset register. Hey, but guess what? It's still there. It's still part of your network. It's still vulnerable. Or we will often have companies who have experienced ransomware attacks or are afraid of ransomware attacks, and we will basically look at their entire organization through the eyes of an attacker. So most of us in my team have experience in dealing with cybercrime or have backgrounds in pen testing, hacking. And what we do, we do have pen testing capabilities, but what we're not doing is not a pen test. We are trying to look more broadly at the entire organization, its people, its assets, its trademarks, and say, this is where you are vulnerable to fraud. This is where you are vulnerable to blackmail. This is where you've got your rogue employee. These are the technical problems that mean you're more likely to suffer a ransomware attack. This is what people on the dark web are saying about you, and so on and so on and so on. So we try and buy their CEOs the ability, or their CISOs more often, the ability to sleep at night. Which is what we do. And we've worked in various ways to automate and scale that so we can do it much more rapidly. But yeah, it's great. You get to, I guess for people who have backgrounds in red teaming and so on, it's kind of like the recon element of a pen test or the recon element of a hack, but at huge scale where you're looking at absolutely every part of the business. Yeah. And we always, it's like a real life CTF for me. It's like, yeah, it's great to find these little things and then help people fix them before the bad guys find them.
As I was looking through your blog, one of the things that I really liked about the site is that oftentimes when I'm trying to do OSINT, one of my frustrations is that I don't know what I don't know. That there might be certain times that, like, I want to do it to get from point A to point Z, but I have no idea, like, what tools there are or what sites there are or how to do that. And that seemed to be one of the many things that you have in a lot of your blog posts. Like, well, for these skyscrapers, I used this site, which is really great at documenting skyscrapers. And I had no idea those types of things existed. Yeah. So I think if people want to know those kinds of things, going through your site would be a huge help. But I think what is probably even more valuable about your site is that, especially when you're doing some of your quiz time explanations, I think people are used to CTF walkthroughs and explanations. And you do that for a lot of the quiz time examples that are out there. And I think one of the things that I really like about that is you're showing your methodology, your step-by-step, how I got from step A to step Z. Like, for example, you had one that you wrote in March of 2020 that referred to gap analysis, where a company just showed a picture of a couple of people out on the street with a bicycle. And the question was that something seems wrong with this picture. What is it? And you kind of surmised that, well, this picture is probably not from the city that it claims to be in. What city might it actually be in? And when I first read that, I'm like, holy crap, I have no idea where to even start with this kind of thing, because I didn't see a whole lot that was really identifiable in the picture. But when I read through your walkthrough, everything makes sense and how you got from the beginning to the end. And one of the things that I really liked in there is that you constantly answer these four questions and you constantly update. Now, the four questions are, what do I know? What does this mean? So what do I need to know and how do I find out? Those seem to be four great questions that can help on any OSINT investigation. And are those standard questions that you ask yourself on OSINT investigations?
The short answer is yes, they absolutely are. I was taught these way back when I think like day one, week one of detective school, well, when I was an EB detective, I had a really good teacher and he said, this isn't in the syllabus, but here's a methodology that has stood the test of time that I use. And it was these four questions. And it's really important because as you mentioned, there are an awful lot of tools and knowing which tools will do what it's a full-time job just to keep on top of them and to learn the new ones and lament the old ones when they just disappear off the internet without any warning. But always more important than your tooling is your methodology. So before you try and solve a problem in an OSINT case, you need to know what you're actually trying to find out. And it's strange because you think when people start doing OSINT investigations of any size and scale, we kind of assume that we know what we're trying to do. But actually, that's often not the case. We often have quite vague ideas that, I need to OSINT this. And if you don't have clear aims in mind about what you're trying to do, you will end up in rabbit holes. And it happens all, and it's so hard to avoid, especially when you're dealing with really large amounts of data. It's really hard to stay on track. It's really hard to focus on the one thing you're trying to find out because you go, oh, here's a phone number. Oh, and here's an address. I wonder who else lives at that address. I wonder who used to live at that address. I wonder if they're up to date with their state taxes. And I wonder what car they own. And before you know it, you've gone 7, 8, 9, 10 points away from the question you were originally trying to answer. So, and it becomes overwhelming. And I think when people start out in investigations of all kinds, not just OSINT, there's a tendency to do that, to try and, I have a good boss who has this phrase, everyone tries to boil the ocean. Like you're trying to do absolutely everything and you can't. So to be a good investigator, to be a good OSINT practitioner, you have to bring a structure to what you do. Otherwise it will collapse and you'll get frustrated and you'll get things wrong. So I started writing about gap analysis and things really as a way to help people to structure their investigations. And yeah, there are different models and there's different ways you could do this, but it's very easy to follow because it forces you to say, hey, what do I actually need? What do I need to know? What do I know already at the start? What do I need to know? What does it mean? And then you have to, instead of just assuming you know the answer to those questions, you actually have to sort of verbalize it or write it down somewhere and say, oh yeah, I do need to know that. And I don't know this bit of information, so I'll go and use this resource to go and find it. And then I'll come back. It's a cycle. But if you stick to this process, it will help you become a much more successful researcher, successful investigator, and minimize the noise and the excess data and things like that, and just focus on what's important.
And I think one of the other things that I've noticed when I read some of these walkthroughs is just also the little things that people like you notice in some of these images. And I saw this same thing when I was speaking with Technoset, where she was walking me through one of her investigations and she showed me a picture that she had to do an investigation on. And one thing that she noticed was the specific color of the recycle bins that were on the side of the road. Or in your instance, the one thing that you picked up on was that there were tram lines in the photo where there was, you know, overhead wires that the trams are going to be able to go through. That's not something that I even noticed or would have even thought like that's something that's important, where it seems like those little levels of detail can be extremely important in an investigation.
Yes, absolutely. And it's a skill when you're not just only when you're dealing with images, but when you are dealing with any data set, any type of information, is picking out, actually taking time to pause and pick out the information that is important. My old detective trainer, he talked about what we had, he called it a foot on the ball moment. So if you played football, and by football I mean European football, not US football, of course, that the really good players don't look busy. Like they They stop in the middle of the field and they put their foot on the ball. They look up and they see what their options are. And the really good players make it look really easy. So it was always drilled into us, you need to have this foot on the ball moment. You need to stop and actually look around, first of all, before you do anything else. So don't rush. Getting out of the habit of rushing is really important. So that ability to pause and to actually look at an image or a data set or whatever it is you're looking at, and actually take time to force yourself to pick out the details, because what's front and center in an image that might have been the most important thing to the photographer, but it might not necessarily be the most important thing to you. In fact, there's a really good exercise that I've taught for people to do this is it's like 20 questions or 20 data points. So you give them an image and they have to find 20 pieces of information in a photo. And if I give you a photo, say, okay, tell me 20 things about the content in that photo, I should say, here's five or six things. Okay, well, you need 14 or 15 more. And they go, and it's amazing. Like you'll see people press, oh yeah, and right, okay, that's the plug socket, and that must be a UK or Ireland plug socket. And the mattress in the background is this color, and there's a label on it with blue writing. And the curtains are red and they're connected with these wooden loops instead of plastic hooks. And outside in the garden, I can see different trees and bushes, and I can see a satellite dish so we can get some better audio. You actually force people to stop and say, right, this exercise is not done until I get 20 pieces of information. It forces people to slow down and pause and observe things. You know, this is like Sherlock Holmes stuff, right? You use like observation, but it's a really important discipline for researchers, not just OSINT practitioners, but any kind of researchers and analysts to actually stop and look at the material they've got and extract every ounce of value they can from it before they rush into the next part of the investigation.
And I think another thing that I learned in reading your blog posts is probably a little bit about that boil the ocean kind of thing that you referenced to, is that when I'm doing investigations, I very quickly want to jump to the brute force. Like, okay, I have these pieces of information. I'm just going to go look up everything that I can possibly find that references those bits of information. And you had one blog post that really dug into that. I think it was this process of elimination from January of this year, where it was a photo of a football soccer player. And the question was in there, I believe was, when was this photo taken?
Yeah.
And you started investigating everything. I think it was a video that you were given and you were able to go through. And one of the things that you were able to find is that at one point during the match, that it was 2-2, you had a pretty easy time of figuring out specifically where it was. At that point, I'm just like, great, we know where it was. So we know who the home team is. We know the score is 2-2. So let's just go look up every game that could possibly be 2-2. And you specifically say in your blog post, no, not yet. We need to do more. There's more filtering that we can do. Can you talk a little bit more about those filters and how you did eventually get this one down to just two possibilities? And out of those two possibilities, only one became obvious.
Yeah. So this is a really useful technique, again, for any kind of investigation, but it's when you work with large amounts of data, you think of it kind of a Boolean way and think like, okay, well, what must be true? Like everything's true in this scenario, everything is true or false. It's either this team or it's not. It's either on a weekday or it's not. It was either this year or it isn't. So you have to think and apply conditions to your data and say, right, how can I eliminate all this? So first of all, I can see, right, I can't remember the exact detail, but I think it was in Germany. I knew that much. So you can apply conditions and say, right, okay, which teams in Germany playing green, for example? So then you look at the league and you say, right, well, there's maybe 20 teams in the top league, and I don't know the exact number, but say 16 of them don't play in green, so we can eliminate those 16. And then they're playing a team in red, for example. So, right, then all the red teams, and then we can eliminate all the teams that play in blue or play in black and white or whatever. And then you can add more and more parameters like that until you eliminate all the things that can't be true. And you can go from a very large amount of information to a very small data set. So yet you could, and this is the problem you alluded to, which is you knew the score was 2-2. So you could just go on Wikipedia or a sports database site, find all the times when this team were playing when the score was 2-2. That's going to give you a large amount of data, because let's say over 10 seasons, maybe, I don't know, 4 or 5 home games, there might have been a stage in the game. Because remember, this is only the score was 2-2. We didn't know the final result was 2-2. So you look at all the games where it might finish 2-2 or 3-2 or 4-2 or 4-5-3, or it could be, you end up with a huge amount of data. So rather than jump, and it's always so tempting just to jump straight into that because it feels instinctively like it's going to be a shortcut. But often it's more work to do that. So I think, well, let's try and be a bit more precise. And there was one guy in the photo, I think, who was identifiable. He was a left-footed player and he wore number 5. So once we knew the team, we don't even have to go through all that team. I think the team was Eintracht Frankfurt, I think. So we could have gone through all their results, but then there might have been 2 or 3 different possible occasions. So rather than just going from there, we have to try and add more and more detail in until you're left with just one, right? It's like an elimination contest. So you've ended up with, this could have been 20 different teams at any point in the last 10 seasons. So it could have been only one of 4 teams. And it could only have been this team, one particular team, because this guy only played for one of them. And so that gives you the team, but then it could have been one of 10 different matches. So how do I eliminate possible matches? Well, I'll identify one of the players, look in the game club records, when did he play there? And well, it just narrows it down to actually a couple of years. So you've gone from really, really big parameters, and just by adding more and more conditions, so exclude if it doesn't match this, exclude if it doesn't match this, exclude if it doesn't match this. And I think people who write code understand this process very well. I think if this is true, then this is not, if else. That's how I kind of think of it. You can have seemingly insurmountable problems and data sets that seem too large, but actually if you focus and patiently eliminate your way through them, then you can find the right answer, or at least get to a very small pool of possible answers in quite a short time.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun to see you walk through and get to the final answer. And eventually it just came down to only one possibility based on all the filters. But you had another blog post in there that I think was a lot of fun to watch you walk through. And this is one that I'm guessing lots of other people would love to replicate themselves, was you had an instance where somebody was stealing your content. Somebody was plagiarizing your work. And you wanted to find out who specifically is this person. And I think there's lots of times that there's people out there that want to figure out who is this person on the internet, because I'm 99.9% sure they're not who that they claim to be on the site. And you actually walked through and found various ways of figuring out specifically who this person was. Can you mention some of the various ways that you were able to figure that sort of thing out?
This was, there are many sites that do this, but there is a whole industry of websites that basically they make their income, such as it is, from the copying content from other people and rebrand it as their own, basically. And through search engine optimization and marketing and so on, they try and direct the traffic to their website so that they get the clicks, they get the affiliate referrals, blah, blah, blah. And they make a little bit of money from it. But it's kind of annoying. I remember coming across this one day and I saw someone who had basically plagiarized a lot of the things I'd written and tried to pass them off as their own content, and which is I'm fairly easygoing. Like, I don't get riled very easily, but it was annoying to see someone, when I've spent hours and hours and hours writing stuff, someone who had basically chosen to copy my site and passed it off as their own and presumably tried to make some money from it, which is a bit annoying. So yeah, so this one is really about digging into a website, and I love doing this because there's always something in a website that's a little bit of a giveaway. So I think they had I was investigating the author and the so-called author of this piece was someone who went by the name of Alicia Newman. When you looked at the image, it was one of the automatically generated face images. You might have seen them on Twitter and very There are sites like thispersondoesnotexist.com, which will generate images like this. They're really commonly used for generating fake profiles, things like that. And they're a bit of a giveaway because regardless of anything else in the photo, the eyes, the nose and the mouth are always in alignment. They're always in the same place. So when you've seen a few of these, you begin to spot them straight away. So I looked at Alicia, but I did something which has so often been a reliable technique in investigation, which is to try and go back in time on a website. And this used to be really good for catching cyber criminals as well, because people usually think about OPSEC, their operational security, after the event. So they don't start out thinking about OPSEC and thinking about how they're going to hide their tracks and things. They usually think about that afterwards. So if you can go back on the internet using something like the Internet Archive, the Wayback Machine, or some things like Google Cache, things like that, although archive.is, but the Wayback Machine is still a good one to go to. You could go back through the Internet Archive, and you could go back through Whois records, because I guess people are maybe familiar with Whois records, but what people are not aware of is that in places like Whoxy and RiskIQ, you can actually go back and look at historic Whois records and say, okay, well, I know who owns the site today, who owned it 1 year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And it became clear that from the changes in hosting history, from the changes in the Whois records, and from what I found in the Internet Archive, that the original site had undergone a change of ownership at one point. And Whois is nowhere near as useful for OSINT as it used to be. Because as people know, if you've ever tried to do Whois on a website, you'll probably just get a load of data that says redacted for privacy and you won't learn anything. And if people have been smart with their OPSEC, even when you do register a website and provide details, there are very few checks no real checks to prove that those details are right. So you always have to treat Whois results with a pinch of salt. But then we looked at things like security certificates. So again, a security certificate can tell you a lot about a website and other websites or subdomains that are associated to it. And again, you can plot all these things together and say, sort of identify changes in ownership or changes in design. So you can look at a security certificate record on something like CERT or CRT.sh, which has all the historic security certificate details. And you can see there were perhaps sudden changes of domain or changes to the certificate or subdomains added at certain periods of time. They basically provide information about where a domain can be found on the internet. So a DNS record will say, well, if you want to visit this particular website, google.com, it's at this IP address. But again, there are sites like RiskIQ and Security Trails, which will show you how this information has changed over time. So I had quite a bit of data showing that the ownership of this website had it had changed IP address, it had changed security certificate, it had changed its content all around about the same time. And all I knew from the Whois at that point was that the person who had registered it and made these changes was based in Kosovo in Southeast Europe. That's all I knew about them at that point. But they use WordPress. And if you're not familiar with WordPress, you are familiar with WordPress because it powers about something like a third of the world's websites. So even if you don't know your way around WordPress, you have used a WordPress website for sure. But there's a great little bug stroke feature in WordPress, which is if you visit a particular URL within a WordPress installation, you can learn all the different users that post on there. Good WordPress admins will disable this, but if you're careless or you make a mistake, you can expose all the usernames of the people that post on your particular website. So I did that. I used a tool called WP Scan, which does this in an automated way. And it basically pulled back all the names of the authors, the people that posted there. So I had a list of maybe 7 or 8 different authors who posted on the website. They all appear to be fake. They all had these generic sort of fake profiles with fake images. But in WordPress, not all users are equal. Every user has a number, and the number is given according to when their account was created on the website. So you're always interested in the very first user, user number 1, because that's the person who set up the website. They're likely to be an admin, because you have to be an admin to set up a managed website. And they're likely to the person behind it. And this person, the user of that website, was someone called Koki. That's all. Didn't know anything about him, no email address, no picture. Just knew that the first person to set up this website, which is plagiarizing my stuff, was called Koki. So had a look at their Facebook page after that. All I have is a name, Koki, and a country, Kosovo. Went to Facebook, and we saw that the Facebook page for this organization was set up at the same time as the website was. So that was a good clue that we're on the right track. They'd also plagiarized their logo from lots of other places as well. And then we got together with one of my OSINT colleagues at that point. We reached out to the owner of the website, and he used Gmail. And if I don't know if you've used Gmail before, but when you have someone's contact in Gmail, you could pull back their profile picture and usually their full name as well. So we used the contact form on the website, just sent a standard inquiry, and we got an automated reply back. And this person, fortunately, had a custom avatar in their profile. He was a guy called Korab. And because he had this unique, distinctive avatar, we could do a reverse image search on it and find other matches for it, and find he used the exact same image on the profile page for the marketing company he worked for. So we had then got his real life name, and we knew the company that he worked for. And from there, we went to find his, because we then had a name. He was in Kosovo, of course. And we found so much information about him based on that. We found like Twitter accounts. We found social media platforms. We found where he went to university. And we found his nickname on Twitter was Coquinho, or Koki for short. So that's where Koki, so that is only a name, but that's where Koki, the site admin, is also Koki, this guy, the guy who's replied to the email. So we were happy that was him. And we found a ton of information about him. And he eventually agreed to take some of the stuff down that we'd done on there. We didn't threaten him, I have to say. We didn't. And we didn't publish half the things that we could have done. Our aim is, or certainly my aim, is not to like embarrass or shame him. It's like, I want you to take my stuff down, stop stealing it. For anyone who is sort of followed along to this point, like probably sending a standard email via the contact portal is probably beyond the bounds of what you call OSINT. That you're beyond, you're actually interacting with, albeit with an automated reply service at that point. But it meant, going back to the original issue, who's stealing my stuff, just from doing this, looking at hosting history, certificate history, who is history, we get a country, Kosovo, we get an approximate date when all these changes are taking place. We find they have a Facebook page set up for them. At the same time, go from Facebook to the person. We get a contact form. We get with the image, do reverse search on the image, find his developer profile page on his company website. And suddenly we have his employer. We have his real name. We get more social media from that. We find out what car he drives, where he lives, where he went to university, what his mum's called. All this kind of stuff. It took a few hours. And I remember I'd been quite annoyed at the start that it happened. I remember being going on it for sort of 3-4 hours and thought, what's my end game here? I can't even remember now. it just turned into a bit. But he was, I wouldn't say he was gracious, but he took the stuff down afterwards. But there's a lesson in that, A, about your privacy and OPSEC if you're going to do something bad. But also about being persistent and combining different types of data. So be that things through how websites hosted, how websites put together with social media, and combining all these different data points together until you got a bit of a story. In this case, it's finding the guy behind it. But yeah, you could do all sorts of this kind of stuff, and it continues to be fun to do so. It's why I love doing it.
And you must have felt like Liam Neeson during all this with that quote where, I have a very specific set of skills. I will find you.
Yeah, you'd be surprised how many people have thrown that Liam Neeson meme at me. there's a sensible point to make about this, which is around about ethics and boundaries and things like that. So I spent most of my, certainly in law enforcement, most of my work there was finding some of the worst people. So obviously you have legal guidelines you have to follow, But there are no issues with being really intrusive into someone. You're trying to find someone who is defrauding old people or abusing children. If you are doing this, you can see how you could apply the same skills to for malicious purposes. So for doxing people that you've fallen out with, or for trying to find your ex-partner, or trying to harass people, things like that. And unfortunately, that's a way in which people misuse those skills. So yeah, it's good to have the skills, but you need to have the wisdom to understand how they can be misused as well, and when to stop, both for legal and ethical reasons too.
Yeah, because it sounded like you had plenty of information there where you could have ransomed the guy and gotten money out of him with just the kind of information that you gathered.
Yeah, exactly. We had his passwords from data breaches and things like that. We could have ruined him if we'd have wanted to, but that's not why we're doing it. Nope. And that's not what it's for. Yeah, you have to stay out of trouble.
And from his perspective, it's also just amazing that the type of person that you're going to steal from is an OSINT person. It's like, if anybody is going to be able to find you, it's going to be an OSINT person. So you better be awfully good at your OPSEC. One question that I've heard from especially beginning or shortly after beginning OSINT people is the value of learning programming and picking up even one scripting/programming language. What's your feel about the value of learning a language like maybe Python?
I think it's fantastic. I wouldn't go as far to say it's absolutely essential. And the reason I don't say it's absolutely essential is because if you put yourself in the shoes of someone who's wanting to get into this, learning coding can seem like another barrier to people. So I would say it's absolutely essential. However, I think as you continue in this profession, this line of work, there are so many advantages from being able to do a little bit of coding, or being able to even use simple command line tools that other people have written. And the reason for that is this, in that if you do everything manually, then you are limited by your ability to pay attention. You are limited by time. You are confining yourself to just working with very, very small data sets, which is fine for a lot of work. But if you, let's say you're doing reconnaissance, for example, you're doing some OSINT and a company has one IP address, it's really easy to do recon on that company. If they have 10 employees and one employee. Now think you've been asked to do recon on a company that has 40,000 employees and they have 2,500 IP addresses in their IP range. Go do that manually. Well, you'll still be here this time next year, right? And the year after. So what automated tools like Python and Bash, for example, that Python is my go-to, they bring the power of automation to things. Like Python doesn't get tired. It doesn't make mistakes. If it makes mistakes, it's because you made a mistake. But it brings that speed, repeatability and scaling to things. So I would say for anyone who is not sure about, yes, acquire those skills. But one thing I would say to really encourage people, because I know I've been there, I still think of, even though I do quite a bit of software development, I still don't think of myself as a developer. I feel like, I'm not a developer. I didn't study computer science and I didn't do any of these things at university. And I just pick it up and I just Google everything on Stack Overflow when I hit an error, which I think most programmers do actually, in all the truthfulness. But don't feel you have to be perfect at writing code. Don't feel if you've seen Spiderfoot, for example, Spiderfoot is written in Python, a really powerful, wide-ranging automated OSINT tool made by Steve McAuliffe, who's a fantastic servant to the OSINT community. Don't feel like you have got to go and make Spiderfoot from scratch, right? It took Steve about 10 years plus to make that. Don't be daunted by Python. Just think of one or two things that you do in your work that are repeatable, that are boring. So perhaps it's copying data from a CSV file, or perhaps putting it into another CSV file, or perhaps it's pulling data from an API on the internet and you need to sort it and put things in a particular order, or you just want to pass out the fields that are of interest to you. It's fairly, the learning curve for that is quite a gentle one. And if you can do basic, simple Python tasks like that, they will make the world of difference to how easy you find it to work with data and to do OSINT at scale and to do it quickly at scale. So don't feel that, oh, I could never do that. I could never code. You can, as long as you just do it, take it in small steps and don't try and do too much at once. But you'll find that even a simple script will not be beyond you, even with a few weeks of practice. And there's loads of really good resources out there that'll help you to do it.
The last question that I'd like to ask all my guests, what tips or advice would you give to somebody just breaking in today to be able to get to where you are today?
That's a really good one. First of all, is learn not to rush. That's probably the most, it's not very exciting skill, I think, but where people are who are successful in OSINT, in whatever capacity they do it, are the ones who make mistakes, because you learn from your mistakes, but the ones who learn to take the time and learn the methodology behind things. So you might be a whiz with Google Maps, or you might be a whiz with reverse image searches. So don't rush to become a master of every single tool. Take time to learn how to solve a problem, how to do something like gap analysis, how to structure your approach to things. Because I think with people who just start out in this field, a couple of mistakes that cause people to go to waste time in their development and not go forward as quickly is that it's rushing too much into things. So to give you an example, I had a conversation with an OSINT professional who works for the UK government, and he said it was driving him mad that when he got new OSINT practitioners in, they still have the CTF mindset, and the first answer they find becomes the right one. I said, oh, we're searching for this person. Oh, I found a username. Right, yeah, that's him. And they don't verify it. They don't check it. They don't consider alternate explanations. And that's where they go wrong. So take time to learn how to do things slowly and practice your skills. And take time to learn the methodology, how to structure, how to tell truth and false. How do you check if something's true? Like, that's a massive skill that we take for granted. So learn to do that. The tools that you're learning today, probably most of them won't even exist in 3 years' time. Like, that's just the reality. Things like Google, we hope will stick around. Half the other tools that are popular today in OSINT probably won't exist tomorrow. Like, it's just the reality that they're very short-lived. But if you can take time to learn that methodology, to learn how to think through problems, how to prioritize things, how to weigh up whether something is true or not, how to practice that observation skill to extract all the data from it, those skills will not go away. You will always require them. So yeah, if you're just starting out, learn, spend time doing CTFs, spend time doing write-ups, do things like quiz time or OSINT.games, learn the methodology side of it, and you will have a long and successful career with a good foundation. So yeah, learn how to think through things.
I think that's great advice. Are there going to be any places, presentations, either at conferences or OSINT Curious, or are you teaching Sec 487 anytime later this year, maybe next year, where people can see you?
Yeah, so at the moment, I'm planning to teach Sec 487 a couple more times this year. I'll be teaching a class in Stockholm in September, and I will be teaching another class, I think, late November in Amsterdam. So I will be teaching OSINT in person there. Conference-wise, I haven't anything for the next couple of months. We will still be doing the OSINT Curious webcast. We do that roughly once a month. I have a couple of tutorials in the pipeline. I hope to get those out for the end of the summer. But yeah, I will always be on Twitter, more than is good for me, actually. But yeah, I will always be on Twitter. If I find anything interesting or want to discuss something, I'll usually fire it out on there first.
So thank you so much, Stephen. So glad that you were able to join us. Nix Intel is where people can find you. Thanks for joining.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Layer 8 podcast. Please join us in Providence, Rhode Island on Saturday, October 8th for the 5th annual Layer 8 conference. The Layer 8 Conference is a 501c3 nonprofit organization as designated by the United States Internal Revenue Service.